Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the Pot of Thunder and Rock and Roll, and let's go with the highly anticipated Duff McKagan joke of the week.
Hey, Chris Jericho, Susan Holm McKagan here. So my husband tells me I have two major faults. One is I don't listen, and the other is something else.
Susan Holmes McKagan, Duff's lovely wife, getting in on the action this week. Thank you, Susan, for helping out Duff and being actually probably even funnier than he is. We love you both here on Talk is Jericho. And of course, we love Lance Storm returning to TIJ because we're going to tell the whole story about our first trip to Japan when we went to wrestle for FMW in October of 1991. Oh my gosh, almost 32 years ago. You'll hear it from the very beginning. And we aren't leaving any details out, from the flights over to Japan to the hotels we stayed in, drinking bars, the matches, the opponents, juicing for the first time. And as crazy as it sounds, we actually went over there without any visas. We got ripped off money-wise. We got on the plane to go across the world with no contact information for who would be meeting us on the other end. I was 20 years old. Lance was 21, maybe 22. Crazy to think about that now. My son Ash is 19. There's no way I'd let him go to Japan with no visa and no contact information, but that's the way we did it, and it was the way it was, and we liked it. So here we go. Lance Storm and the FMW Sudden Impact hits Japan October 1991 right here on Talk is Jericho.
All right, so I listen to Lance Storm every week on Wrestling Observer Live with Brian Alvarez. And Lance always has great commentary and drives himself insane with booking issues or whatever. But lately, you have been doing something which I find really cool, is kind of your history in the business from the beginning with all the different countries and territories and places that you went. And you did one recently about your first tour, aka my first tour, aka our first tour of Japan. And I listened to it and I enjoyed it so much that I thought, well, we should do that on my show, because there's a lot of things that you said I didn't remember, and I'm sure vice versa, and just a lot of great memories and that sort of thing. So that's what we're going to talk about today, our first tour of FMW. And I also have, just for extra added memory pulls, is the complete list of Jericho. And we'll go through every match that we had and see if we remember anything about it as well. And I haven't looked through this. I'm completely cold as well. And we'll just see kind of what happens for this tour.
Oh, God.
That was October 10th, 1991. So tell us kind of the background of how this all happened and kind of what led us to do this tour in the first place.
Okay, before we get to that, I do want to mention, this is why I was totally into doing this show, is I find it so amazing that I will have memories that you're 100% positive or accurate, but you're going to have different ones. And then when you bring them up, I'll be like, oh crap, you're right. Yeah. And it's nice to be able to pool our collective memories, because as we get older, they may not be the best.
And just to get in there too, another thing about these years as well that's so important for us to document as much as we can is, like, this is pre-internet era, pre-websites and YouTubes. Like, there's really no documentation of these times. There's a couple snapshots, a couple pictures comes up once in a while, but other than our memories, there's nothing that's ever really been told about this before.
Yeah, and so many people today don't realize that cell phones weren't a thing, let alone smartphones that had good cameras in them.
Right.
That you had to actually bring a physical camera with film with you to get shots, which is why we have so few.
Or the instant camera where you click it and wind it, and then you throw it in your bag and take it to the drugstore and they give you the prints 10 days later.
Yes.
So I didn't mean to interrupt you. So you're talking about how this kind of all came to be in your recollection.
Yeah. You know, Chris and I were both, you know, we were Sudden Impact. Everybody thinks we were the Thrill Seekers the whole time, but we started as Sudden Impact as a tag team working for a guy named Fred Jung. Our second show was promoted by Jung. Yeah, and we worked as Sudden Impact. So we're constantly looking for a break. And Fred, who to this day is probably the guy I least like, would be closest to attribute the word hate to my description of him in the business.
And it's funny because young kids these days will still tell me stories of, like, yeah, I really want to work more, but I'm not allowed to leave, you know, my company. So how often does your company run? Well, once a month. It's like, well, you can't work anywhere else. And that was kind of Fred Jung's thing. He was, I don't know. So in October of 91, I was 20. And what were you, 21 or 22, Lance?
22.
So we're just kids, like 20. I'm not even legal in the States yet, which is so crazy to even think about. And Fred was probably 24, 25, but he was one of those guys.
I think he was between us. I think I might have actually been a touch older than him.
Wow.
I think that was part of the problem. Like, there was a lot of indie politics, you know, guys that lied to us, you know, Ed promising the Germany trip, Fred promising this.
Right.
And I think I could tolerate it from the people that were older than me. But the fact that it's like, you didn't know who he was. Like, you know, he says he promoted shows that use Dynamite Kid, but I'm like, I've never heard of you. You can't look him up because there's no internet. So it's like, who is this young guy? And I have a tendency to believe he's completely full of crap.
But we didn't know for sure, because he was, like you said, a younger guy, always dressed up nice, kind of had airs of being somebody, which is a great way to kind of, you know, manipulate people into believing you. And he was always saying that, like you said, he used to run shows with Dynamite Kid. And he had an in with a guy called Ricky Fuji, who was Masanori Morimura, who had wrestled in Calgary. I think kind of the last dregs of Stampede Wrestling. He had come to train with Mr. Hito or something like this.
Yep.
And Ricky Fuji worked for FMW. So Fred was always promising Japan. And much like you mentioned Ed Langley in Germany, which the story of that quickly is that he kept promising us that we'd go to Germany. He was our original trainer. And, you know, okay, like, it's next week, get your passport ready. And then it's 2 weeks from now. Fred was the same. I remember Fred going, okay, you guys got a tour coming up. Your work visa is going to be in the FedEx. It's coming there at 10:30, literally waiting by the gate. Like, is my visa coming? And like, nothing. And so it was always kind of getting pushed back more and more and more. It's like you said, is this guy even real?
Yeah. And the saving grace for him was he got Rick Bogner, Rick Titan, the second Razor Ramon.
That's right.
He got him booked. So we had seen footage of Rick on VHS tape, and Rick had come back and said he went to Japan and it was cool. So it's like Fred had credibility.
But he was the first one, though, after kind of spinning the plates on all of us, including Rick. He finally got Rick over there. Rick was about 6'8", probably 260, 270. And back in those days, that was kind of the most important thing, was how big are you? Especially when you go to Japan. So he was the first guy to kind of go over there and have the first, you know, jump into the pool, shall we say.
Yeah. And if memory serves, Fred approached you to be number two. And I think you pitched I'm in a tag team. What about us both?
That was back in the day when it was like, we're a tag team. And like, you know, it's like our first year in the business. Like, well, I got a tag. I remember Michael Zanson going, dude, it doesn't work that way. Like, so what? Like,
although it did, you pulled it off.
Yeah, right, right, right.
I was happily Brutus Beefcake to your Hulk Hogan.
But that was Sudden Impact. And from my recollection, and maybe we worked a couple shows for Fred as Sudden Impact, but the Sudden Impact idea was for Japan.
It could be, but I know those two first shows we did, because he had the Predators tag team and he dubbed us Sudden Impact.
Okay.
And we did like two shows. But yeah, he's promising us this Japan trip. We're figuring he's completely full of garbage. There was even, this is, again, the indie politics of, you know, you had to be an Ed guy or a Fred guy. And with the dangling carrot of FMW, we reluctantly became a Fred guy. But then Fred ran that one show that he wouldn't let us on. He allowed me to work it under a hood, and you did commentary as Clint Bobsky with the explanation, and again, 20 and 22, that Onita didn't want us on television. This is cable access in Calgary, because he was afraid Vince McMahon would see us and steal us before our first tour.
So let me ask you this, okay? And once again, obviously, total bullshit. And just to kind of fill in what you're saying, Ed ran one show a month. That was our trainer. Fred ran one show a month. That's the guy's the case to Japan. If you worked for Fred, you weren't allowed to work for Ed and vice versa. It's one show a month. What difference does it make? But anyways, like you said, but he wouldn't allow us on the one show that one month. Why do you think he wouldn't allow us? Because obviously the Onita story is total bullshit.
I have no idea, unless it's just the power play to be able to tell us something.
Hmm.
You know what I mean? It's like to make us listen, to make us obedient. I have no idea.
Interesting.
But yeah, I wrestled under a hood as the Black Mamba. I faced Fabulous Paul Laser in a tag match. But yeah, I have no idea why. Maybe it was to try to make us think that's, you know, the FMW thing's even bigger because Onita is voicing an opinion on it.
I think being like such a pathological liar, because there was another time that Lenny Gillespie and I drove all the way to Vancouver with Fred on the auspices that we needed to get our work visa to go to work for Benjamin Mora in Tijuana, Mexico. But you can't get a work visa. You got to drive to either Vancouver or drive to LA. But when we got to Vancouver, something happened and we couldn't go to LA. But we were literally, this psycho is literally driving 14 hours with us for a lie. And we didn't know any better.
Nope.
But that's how he was. Here's another little tidbit. See if you remember this. Sudden Impact was one idea that he had. He had another idea for our tag team name. Do you remember what that was?
No, none at all.
The Northern Lights.
That's right.
And the idea was he was going to get tights made with fabric that actually would shoot light up and down it. And I remember I asked him, like, who are you, Willy Wonka?
The magic fabric that changed colors.
Like, how are you going to do that? He's like, no, we got this fabric. It can change color as you work. But Northern Lights was an idea.
Which actually is a pretty decent name, too, considering that sure. We were from Canada and so forth.
Quite honestly, Sudden Impact is a pretty cool name as well. In retrospect, at the time, I remember thinking, kind of cheesy, but it's a pretty good name, especially for us, because we were very quick. But we were Calgary kids, so as they called us. So we had some hard-hitting tendencies to us as well. I thought that was a pretty cool name.
Yeah, I will give Fred that. He did have good ideas for names. Do you remember when the first contract he produced for us that I, to this day, swear he took Rick's contract and whited out Rick's name and changed the dates and claimed that this was our contract that we had to sign to get us the visas that we never, ever actually got?
Dude, I mean, that's, you know, and once again, that's kind of, we can tell it now, but yeah, we did not have work visas going from Canada to Japan. Now, nowadays, that's insane. Like, I would never, you know, we didn't know any better. Of course, you wouldn't do it now, but we didn't have any other choice. We didn't sign a contract. Like you said, I think that was a fake contract, a facsimile. And do you remember the one time, I don't know if you were there or not, we went to Denny's to celebrate Titan's WCW contract?
No.
So Fred pulled out a contract from WCW, and I vividly remember it to this day. It was the same idea of a white piece of paper with whatever contract he had photocopied for something else. On the top was a WCW logo in color, but it was right from the WCW magazine. He took it from the magazine, put it on this piece of paper, photocopied it, and made it look legit. Except I remember thinking, like, I don't know anything about contracts. Would they really use the logo from the magazine on a contract? Maybe. I don't know. I didn't say anything, but I was like, that's when we were starting to realize this guy's kind of full of shit, because he was plotting us against each other. He plotted me and Lenny against each other. He probably plotted you and me against each other. You know, I think at some point I just said, go fuck yourself. I'm not doing this anymore.
But that's the thing. Like, a lot of people might be listening and going, why do you put up with it? But it's when you've got your once or twice a month booking in Calgary or maybe Winnipeg. Actually, I don't think we've been to Winnipeg. Well, you would have.
We didn't have Winnipeg, I don't think, yet.
On the 2% chance that it pans out, you put up with a lot of crap because you're looking for that break.
Yeah.
Like, when the plane tickets showed up, I still didn't fully believe it.
Like you said, because this is our world at the time, which is the Calgary scene. Because we hadn't been to Winnipeg yet. I think my first tour of Winnipeg was in 92, and this is the end of 91.
I'm pretty sure you went right before Christmas, so after this tour, and I started.
You're right.
February or like it was.
Yeah, I was there in September, just looking at it right now, is the book that I have here. So anyways, it's Calgary. It's a little bit of Winnipeg. So in this world, you don't want to piss off Fred Jung, because maybe he's right. And Titan did go to Japan. So we really want to go. And then we finally got the chance, and it happened. We didn't get the visas, the contract we weren't sure about, but the plane tickets came. And these are old school plane tickets for people that aren't as old as us. It's a paper ticket. So when you have whatever it was, two or three connections, it's a thick ticket. And if you lose this thing, you're in big trouble, mister. So you don't lose that ticket. So we finally did get booked. I don't remember if it was a month before or 2 weeks before, but away we go. Our passport's ready and we're getting ready for this tour.
Yeah. And me being the guy who abides by rules and likes to do everything straight up, I was really nervous by the, just say you're visiting Ricky Fuji and this is a vacation.
Yeah.
I think they provided his address for us. And so we fly over, and then worse yet, you know, you get to customs and immigrations and it's like, we're taller than most of the Japanese people there. And I'm just like, I'm sticking out like a sore thumb. It's like, they're totally going to nail us at the border. And I was like, just terrified.
Well, before we get to the border, let's talk about the flight. The day comes that we're getting ready to go over there. So I live in Okotoks, which is south of Calgary. The airport is north of Calgary. So the idea is I'll come to your house and we'll drive there together.
Yeah, I was renting a room from Steve Gillespie.
Steve Gillespie was a local Calgary wrestler.
Yeah. So Chris was going to drive, leave his car at Steve's place, and then Steve would take us to the airport. And much like I am a rule abider, I am also chronically early. So I'm thinking that we have to, you know, get to the airport this many early. And I'm figuring, okay, we have to leave by, let's say, 9 o'clock. 9 o'clock rolls around and no Jericho, and there's no cell phone, so you can't call the guy.
Right. Good call, man. Jeez.
And it's like, again, if we were supposed to leave by 9, I'm probably pacing at the door in my, you know, shirt and tie at 8:30, figuring that, you know, we need to make a good impression and be early and be on time. Jericho pulls up at 9:20 or something, all casual with a, all right, let's go. So,
well, let me say this. I had to get either someone gave me a ride or maybe I had my car, but I remember I did not do that being nonchalant. Like I'm the same as you, dude. Like I need to be at the airport an hour before. I've always been that way. Something went down because I lived in the farm in Okotoks and something happened where I was too like, we got to go, man. And maybe Brad Palco, the guy I was living with, gave me a ride. Something happened where I was freaking out too. So I didn't take it lightly. I wasn't like, you know, I might've been nonchalant when I got to you, but I was pretty freaking out. But my favorite thing is we're flying to Japan. We got to go Calgary to LA, LA to Tokyo, Narita. I've got, you know, probably at the time jams, like those kind of sweatpant fabric things and a t-shirt, whatever. Lance is wearing a shirt and a tie. What was your mindset for the shirt and the tie?
I think it was just, again, you know, training my dad. It's like, you know what I mean? You're going to a new job. It's supposed, you know, it felt to me like this was a big deal. I should look professional and show up like I mean serious business. So I put on a shirt and a tie, not realizing that we're just going over there and getting picked up by the referee and heading to a hotel. But I wanted to make a good impression. And again, I'm going to keep my memory that you were totally casual and nonchalant because okay. It's a better story in my head.
Well, and maybe that, but I do remember something happened along the way that did throw it off. It wasn't like it's time to go. And of course, as well, you know, you could have just put a shirt and a tie in your carry-on and went to put it on 10 minutes before you landed.
Yeah, could have put it on 14 hours later.
Just a quick story, but when we were flying from Calgary to LA, we got on the flight and the Edmonton Oilers were on the flight too. They had just played the Calgary Flames. And I had this is classic, you know, Brian Adams, God bless him, late great Brian Adams crush, would always say like, I got a terrible seat on the plane. They gave me middle seat smoking. And literally at the time, there was a smoking section and a non-smoking section. And I had middle seat smoking going from Calgary to LA. I sat next to a guy who was obviously he's an Oiler. You can tell. Big guy. This is before they flew private. And he looked so familiar. And I couldn't place it. So he gets up to go to the bathroom and I look, his carry-on is in between under the seat. So I pull the carry-on out and I look at the name tag and his name is Dave Semenko, one of the all-time toughest players in NHL history. He was Gretzky's shadow. If you mess with Gretzky, Semenko would kill you. I look at the thing, Dave Semenko, and then I hear this, get your hands off my fucking bag. And it was like, he's standing right there. He sits down. I get the longest 3 hours of my life. I'm sorry. Just looking at the ground.
I got stuck middle seat smoking once from LA to Japan. It was the longest flight of my life. I think thankfully they weren't as strict on staying in your seat. And I think I got out of my seat and spent the whole flight standing and non-smoking.
But that's how it was for probably the first 5 years of our career. I mean, we were going to Japan quite a bit. The only time I ever had first class is if I was able to finally get a voucher somehow after getting so many frequent flyer miles. And even then, you would call 10 times sometimes before they would put it through. But if not, you were like this. I almost think we didn't even know how to change our seats or you couldn't do that back then. But I always had a middle seat. So anyways, we get to Tokyo. Like you mentioned, we go to customs with no visa, blatantly lying that we're there as tourists. And also, here's another thing. Like you mentioned, no cell phones. And all we were told is someone's going to pick you up.
Yes, we have no contact information other than Fred.
Now, I'm thinking my poor parents, all of our parents, were like, if my son got a gig in Japan, it would never happen this way nowadays, but he's 20 and he's going to Japan and all he has is a someone's going to pick you up there and you don't have a visa. I mean, that's human trafficking. Literally.
No phone, no contact information for him or for you to contact him when he's in Japan.
Nothing. I do remember, though, we go and the referee was called Ito.
Yep. Sounds familiar.
And he was there on FM. Like, once we got there, obviously, they're making themselves known. They've got the FMW tracksuit, which at the time were a bright orange. We have those pictures. So, and maybe he wasn't wearing a tracksuit, but I remember that we knew that that was the guy.
And I think he had a sign, you know, probably Sudden Impact or whatever on it. And he grabbed us and then took us to the FMW because, unlike War, when we were there where we were all on the same bus, FMW had the Japanese bus and the Gaijin bus.
Yeah.
And I think we had to wait around for a couple of the other foreigners to get in because there was Mike Awesome, Horace Boulder, Mark Starr, and then we had Ultraman, who was later Damien 666, I believe, and Pandita, which was a Mexican dude in a panda outfit.
He's literally in a full-on panda outfit. And the reason why is Japanese love pandas. They're kind of like very spiritual creatures. So Pandito would come to the ring as this lovable little panda, hand out candy to the children, and was probably the most obnoxious, annoying character in the ring if you weren't, you know, a 12-year-old kid.
Yeah, but we're not talking tights that are painted like a panda and a lucha mask that looks like a panda.
Yeah, no.
Like, he looks like a big stuffed animal bear with the big round head.
Yes.
And the padded costume. It was ridiculous.
He's like wearing a full-on, like, Winnie the Pooh costume, but it's a panda. And I remember his name was Alvarado, and he was super ugly. He had a big nose, like, pockmarked face. And, you know, like, these guys, they probably came over for less than what we came over for, but just happy to be there. Like, we were in Japan. The first night at the hotel, it was a business hotel, which now is about the size, less than the size of my office here. It's a very small place. But they gave us the room, 1,000 yen or 1,500 yen.
No, it would have been, it was $100, 10,000 yen.
10,000 yen, sorry. So 10,000 yen. And it's 10 $1,000 bills. You probably took the picture, I still have it, of me in the robe from the hotel holding the 10,000 yen and just like, we're the fucking Stones, man.
We've made it.
We're Mick and Keith now. Like, we've got all this money and we've got free hotel room.
They gave us a room each.
A room each for free. But then you got to go find something to eat.
Oh my God.
Do you remember this?
I remember having to go to something and thinking like, we're going to starve to death because you can't just Google fast food near me on your phone.
Yeah.
You have to wander the streets and hope you can find something. And I think we ended up just finding something at the Lawson Station.
Well, and that's exactly what happened because it was kind of like a business district. It was a business hotel. So it was not like a tourist area. Or like if you're talking Tokyo, like Shinjuku or Shibuya, you walk out the front, it's like Times Square. This was not that. It was very dark. I remember it was raining. And so you walk outside and we found a Lawson Station, which is like a 7-Eleven. But I remember like, well, we found the place, but then you go in there and it's like, what are we going to eat? Like cream cheese sandwiches and like pizza with squid and corn on it. Chicken fingers that are 95% fat. I remember I bought a big thing of milk because I was a milk guy and I drank fucking half of it. And I was just like, oh my God, I spit it everywhere. It was goat milk. Just nothing really to eat, like you said, right?
Yeah. And I believe we tried to eat in the restaurant of the hotel in the morning. And we found out that you have to be very specific that you want your eggs really, really, really cooked.
Yes.
Or you get slightly warmed raw eggs.
Yeah, like basically like snot.
Yes.
Tell us some more of the stuff that you remember. And then afterwards, we can talk about the actual matches.
I do remember that the Americans kayfabed us a bit for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
I think they had some recreational items with them that they wanted to kayfabe us on.
Yeah, they brought some weed with them over there. I remember the one time we stopped at a truck stop and they just walked away from us. And we're like, oh, that's kind of weird. It was kind of like a forest around it. And we walked down the path and we saw them at the end of the path. And we thought, well, maybe we should go over there. They probably obviously don't want us. And then I remember a couple of days later, Mark Starr was like, what did you guys think when you saw us on the path? And I thought like, well, you know, guys are probably just hanging out or like, he's like, you know, I think I figured out, I think you're smoking a joint. And they're like, good. We thought that you might think that we were buggering each other.
Oh, really?
He literally said that. We thought maybe you thought that we were out there, you know, like making out or whatever it was. It's like, I didn't think it.
Not what we were thinking.
I just thought maybe you guys were smoking a joint. But that kind of broke the ice because these guys were three Florida guys. Mike Awesome, Gladiator, was from Tampa. Horace Boulder, which, did you know he's Hulk Hogan's nephew?
Yeah, and they're like cousins or something by marriage.
By marriage, right. He's also Hogan's nephew. And then Mark Starr was another guy. All three of them ended up in WCW at one point. So they were just once again, because there was a Florida connection, because Tarzan Goto, who was second in command to Onita, his wife Despina was a Florida girl. So that was the Florida connection to bring over any foreigners you could find from that area. And then they had the Calgary connection, which was Titan, Lance and Chris. Dr. Luther was very popular there. Gillespie ended up going over there as Dr. Hannibal. So there was kind of a connection that they were pulling these foreigners from.
Yeah, and they eventually warmed up to us. Because again, you know, I who was it? There was someone recently, like a pot infraction in Japan is much more serious.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
Matt Sydal.
Yes, that was, yeah. He had some serious issues. But yeah, other than that, I'm trying to think. Again, our first night, because I do want to go chronological with this, to tie in.
Let's talk about that.
We, separate locker room, separate bus. So we get to, you know, the building and we're taken to our locker room and it's just the five of us again and the referee, and they've got the lineup on the wall. And I go over and look, and I'm looking for a tag match with like Sudden Impact on it or Lance Storm and Chris Jericho on it. And I look down the sheet and I don't see our names. And this is how insanely paranoid I was with Fred. I looked at it and went, he f***ed us. We're not booked. Like, the ref picked us up. They gave us money. And I still think Fred lied to us and we're not actually booked because we're not on the card. And I remember running into you, or I looked on the thing and see that, and I'm thinking that motherfucker f***ed us. And then I look over at you and I'm like, can you believe this? And you go, I know, it's crazy, right? Or something to that effect.
Yeah.
So I think you're on the same page with me, and you go, we're in the main event. And I'm like, what? So I go back and I look at the sheet, and the main event is a six man, which is why I didn't look at it. And the names on the sheet are Kleise, C-L-I-S-E, I think, and Runtz.
Yeah.
R-U-N-C-E. And it's like, oh, it's Kleise and Runtz. We're in this match.
See, now, from my side of the coin, I was really into a Japanese metal band in the 80s called Loudness. We figured you can't say the L sound in Japanese. You know, the L sound is an R. The R sound is an L. And I kind of just knew that from being a fan and reading some articles and whatever. So when I was looking at the sheet and kind of by the process of elimination, I was like, well, Kleise, Runtz, those aren't guys. So Kleise, is it possible that the L is supposed to be an R, which would be Kreis? And is it possible that the L, R is supposed to be an L, which is Luntz? And I'm like, that's us, man. That we're Kleise and Runtz.
And we're in the main event of our first show in Japan. I had 30 matches. You might have had a couple more because you did Winnipeg.
Yeah.
But we are green, 1 year in the business, kids from Calgary. And we're in the main event against Atsushi Onita.
Yeah.
Sambo Asaka, who is a former sumo guy, and a Korean kickboxer named Weda, who wrestles in boxing gloves.
Yeah. And Mark Starr was our partner, and we were in Kanagawa, Japan. And oh, listen, here's the thing. I don't know what Fred did. I don't know how he pumped us up, but they had us in the main event the very first night. I had 41 matches. This is my 41st match. You said you had 30. And I'm reading the finish here. Do you remember what the finish was that night?
Onita pinned Mark Starr.
That's right. So think about that. They didn't even have us take the fall.
Yeah, which I think in hindsight, what a better way to make new stars than not beat us our first night in. But I remember too, because we'd never even met the other three. Only the ref, Ito, came back and forth. And in my memory, the only instruction we were given was Onita up on Mark with his Thunderfire powerbomb, and Chris and I were to get color.
Get juice.
We were to get busted open and bleed in this match. And neither one of us had ever done that. And it's like, that was it. It's like, just go have a main event.
Yeah.
And it was, I think Mike might have been one of the others, but the Americans had blades because FMW was a big blood promotion. We didn't have stuff for that.
Yeah.
So they made us blades, showed us what we were doing and give us some advice. And we prepared to head out. And the other, and I'm curious if it was just natural coincidence or whether you actually did this as a rib on me. We're going to the ring and I'm thinking it's like, okay, Mark's been here before and you and I agreed. So it's like, I'm just assuming he's going to start. And we get in the ring, and at least in my memory, we stand in the ring and they do the introductions, and I turn around to step out of the ring and you and Mark are standing on the apron. And I'm like, son of a bitch, I guess I'm starting.
Well, it wasn't a rib, but I was super nervous. I didn't want to start. Like, I didn't know what to do. And I remember that whole tour, I was like, will you just start, Lance? Like, I just, like, you had, for whatever reason, had a bit more confidence or whatever. You're like, fuck it, I'll do it. I was nervous. I was scared because we would also do a double backflip from the top rope.
Yes.
And I'd say if we had 10 matches, which I think we had, I probably bailed on five of them. Like 5 out of 10 times, I didn't make it. And it was one of those things that I was just really nervous and just really kind of, what are we fucking doing here? And like you said, there's no spots called.
Nothing.
We didn't see anybody. I know who Onita is. Sambo is this big, he's probably our height, but he's a big round roly-poly guy. And Weta, he looked like a villain in an Indiana Jones movie. He's smiling. He had no front teeth. And he's wearing boxing gloves and boxing shorts.
Yeah, the kickboxing shorts, yeah.
Yes. And just you mentioned that Boulder made my blade. I still make blades to this day exactly that way that Boulder showed me. I make them for everybody in AEW because no one knows, no one's ever done it before, right?
Yeah.
And I also think, like, when you see those horrible, like, mass transit New Jack butcheries, they easily could have went, watch this. Here's the blade, kid. Just do it. Like, no tape, no protection.
Oh, yeah. They could have really ribbed us bad.
And then, and also, too, during the match, I lost my blade. And I was so scared. I didn't know what to do. And I don't remember if someone bladed me or if I used someone else's blade or if I just didn't blade at all.
You didn't get color because
I didn't get
that
color,
was
right.
I assume why. On at least two other occasions on the tour, you were asked to get color and I wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to make sure it was an accident and you just didn't do it.
Yeah.
But jumping back to the beginning of the match, and this was a good rib, because I do remember, I think it was Mike, before we went out, he did mention, he says, you want to get over, he says, Sambo, as big as fat as he actually takes a good body slam. So if you want to get over, you can slam the guy. I'm like, oh, okay, cool. So you guys are out there, and I start with Sambo, and I'm like, okay, he's the veteran, because I'm just, you know, green nobody. He'll do something. And I tied up with him, and he just stood there and did nothing. So I had to just start fighting him.
Yeah.
And at some point in time, I figured it's like, okay, I'll body slam him. Well, it was a rib. He does not go up well. I barely got him off the ground, and it was the worst body slam in the history of the world. And I remember because our locker room was up, there was windows. You could watch the arena area from our locker room. And after the world's worst body slam, I looked up and they were laughing their ass off at me.
I mean, you just walked right into that one. You know what I mean? Like, come on, man.
And that's a good rib.
It's a great,
like, rib, you know, yeah. Giving you a hatchet and, you know, requiring 18 stitches for a laugh is a bad rib.
Not a rib. But
that was a good one.
Here's something that wasn't a rib, but it was essentially a rib on me. Because I think at the point when you tagged out at some point, my first guy was Weta.
Yep.
Now, if I mentioned Weta to Lenny right now, I said, Lenny, what do you think of Weta? He said, the stiffest fucking guy he's ever wrestled in his life. This guy, because FMW was Frontier Martial Arts Wrestling, and they used a lot of martial artists that didn't know anything about wrestling. I'm sure when he said, just go in there and beat him up. And that's what he was beating the hell out of me. And there's no working or, like, you know, okay, kid, like, it's just fight, 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 corner, kicking, 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 kicking. And in FMW, like you said, there were no rules. It became what ECW became. It was Puerto Rico style, which was just then FMW, then ECW. There's no rules. And I remember at one point, this guy's just kicking my ass so bad. I just literally rolled to the floor. I grabbed a chair. I came back in the ring and I hit him as hard as I could on the fucking head with the chair. And I remember he looked at me kind of like, why'd you do that? And kind of lightened up on me after that. But I didn't know what else to do. Like, he was beating me up so bad. I'm just like, I'm just going to hit him with a chair. I guess you're allowed to do that here.
Yeah. See, my memory, because I remember, or at least I have a memory of the Americans warning us that that guy will eat you up if you don't fire back.
Right.
And I have a memory of him backing you into a corner and start throwing knees to your body and you just punching him right in the face.
Yeah.
Because, and that's one thing that Chris will not back down from a fight, and if shit's on, he will throw. And he threw, and thankfully, because he was fine with me, because I worked with him again later in the match, and we're just brawling. But there was a point where there was a table set up against the post, and I don't know if it was him or Sambo grabbed me and started running me at the table. And I'm like, I guess this is when I'll get color. And I ran into the table and fell down and came up with color. And it was the first time I'd ever gotten it. And it seemed fine by everybody. And we just brawled until
that's all it was,
until yeah. we saw Onita hit the power bomb. And it's like, oh, I guess we're done now.
And that's literally what it was. Every match was just fighting, brawling, fight. And it was just, I remember just thinking, this is so strange to me. Like, we've talked about before when we had the show about our first match. Like, it's not like we had everything planned out back then, but we knew a spot or two and we kind of had some ideas. This was none of that. Like you said, Onita over Mark with the powerbomb, you guys get color, have at it.
Yep.
And Onita was so popular that all they wanted to see was Onita get the win and do his shtick, which was Wild Thing playing, which is the same version that Mox uses in AEW. Everybody would rush to the ring and Onita would be crying about how he's so honored and this fighting spirit. He would pour water over his head and they would stay for 20-30 minutes. It was the damnedest thing you've ever seen. He was so over. Like, to me, he was as over as Austin in 2001, you know, Rock in 2000. He was so fucking popular.
It was crazy because FMW was what, number three, maybe number four, who knows what company.
Yes.
But he was such a big star. It's like, dude, would sell out baseball stadiums. It would be like a person in Impact Wrestling being so hot that they're selling out stadiums for him. Yeah, he was crazy.
He wasn't quite at that level yet. He might have had a stadium show, but everywhere we went, like, as we worked in Japan for a lot of years with WAR, and then I've obviously with New Japan, I did a bunch of tours. And some places you would go, they're just not good houses. I remember this tour with Onita, and I'm just going over my numbers, which these are numbers that I wrote at the time. I don't know if I'm right or wrong, but I guess there was 2,200 people at that show. And as I go through, they're all basically that. There's one show that's about 350, which I think was in a parking lot, if you remember the parking lot show.
Yep. I think you had to get color on that show.
I had to get color on that show, yeah. Now, do you remember one of the first nights when we actually went out on the town?
Vaguely. I don't have a lot of memories, but I do have a few photos from it. So I do have some memory that the company took us out to some bar and they had, you know, they would have women that would sit with you and they would bring you drinks and they'd get you up to dance. I'm assuming the women were a gimmick to get you to drink more and you know, spend more money and stuff. But I do have a memory of that.
I've got a picture in the Complete List of Jericho of me, Ricky Fuji, and Lance Storm cutting a rug. What they're called is they're called drinking bars. So you go into the bar, you sit down, you get a bottle of whiskey or whatever. Girls surround you. They pour your drinks. They basically bring you food. They flirt with you like mofos. And then that's it. They're done.
Then you get a bill.
No, see, I didn't know that. Ricky Fuji, it wasn't the office. It was Ricky Fuji took you and me and maybe Ito. It was just the three or four of us. It wasn't everybody. And we go to this bar and we sit down and all these girls come over. I'm 20. I'm like, oh my God, like we're over in this place, man. This is great. And there's one girl you're super flirting with. Oh, I'm going to have to take her back to the business hotel. This is what a great, you know, first night or whatever it was. And it's like, would you like another bottle? Yes, I would love another bottle. And I remember, like you said, at the end of the night, all the chicks left. And I was like, where are you going? And then they give us the bill. I'm like, a bill? Like, I thought this was free. Why would it be free, Chris? I don't know. I just thought it was free. I thought the girls were going to go home with me and I had free liquor. What a great place. The bill cost about $600, which was a week's pay for us. I don't know which one of us pitched in. I'm sure we probably all did the best we could. But I was remember thinking, wow, what a scam that was, you know? And I don't think I ever went back to another drinking bar. Like, I don't want to do this. Like, this is terrible that you got to pay extra for the bottle and the girls just basically flirt with you and leave you hanging. This sucks.
But, and then back to the matches. Like, I remember working with Goto a lot.
Yeah.
As well as obviously, you know, some of the young lions, you know, including Eiji Ozaki, who would later become Hayabusa.
Yeah. Our second match was in Aichi, Japan. And it was us versus Ozaki and the Shooter, who later became the Punk, just Punk.
Was Gnosuke or something his name?
He was Honda. The Shooter became the Punk, some kind of Punk.
Okay.
So, but these were young boys. And I think after the main event, they probably realized like these guys might be out of their element in just these fights. Let's stick them with some of the younger guys and see what they can do. And that's when we started to get a reputation for, I'm not going to go so far as to say we knew how to work, but we were a little bit more advanced than our 70 combined matches would suggest.
I remember having the conversation with Hayabusa when he asked me how long we were working because he thought we were really good. And I was honest with him and said, 1 year, I've had 32 matches or something. And he laughed and said, no, serious. And it's like, he didn't believe me.
Yeah.
And again, we were athletic and we were, we were studying tapes and, you know, doing athletic moves and being noticed in that regard. So we looked better than we were.
I remember doing like the one move, which was my trademark at the time, was the reverse victory roll, aka kind of just a standing Frankensteiner. And I remember that blew their minds. I remember at the end of the tour, Mark Starr is like, did one. He's like, I just wanted to see if I could do one of those. I can't believe it. Like, it was such I'm not even kidding. Like, that was such a revolutionary move at the time that they couldn't believe it. It'd probably be like seeing, you know, Nick Jackson do a 690 or whatever the hell nowadays, you know?
Even like Hayabusa, and anyone who knows Hayabusa and the crazy shit he could do, it's like, he was blown away that we did a double backflip from opposing corners.
Right.
Do you remember the time we decided to try to do one of our trademark high spots? And it was an outdoor show because I remember doing it on the bus. We were trying to convey to the referee our double leapfrog, double clothesline spot. And so we're trying to walk through it where we'd push on the backs of the seat to hold ourselves in the air to try to get the referee to run underneath both of us.
Yes. I vividly remember that. Like you said, using the chairs to push yourself up. So we both are pushed up and the ref kind of was like, he walks underneath the both of us. And we're like, okay, now you come back. And he came back and there's a double clothesline or double elbow, whatever it was, right?
Yeah.
But and here's another thing that I noticed from reading. I remember this too. And back in these days, 1 year in the business, basically. And, you know, we're a tag team, but there's always a little bit of the rivalry. Anytime we got the pin, you got it. Anytime we were pinned, they took it on me.
Really?
Yes. More times than not. So that match with Lance, you got the pin. And then the next match was you and I versus Goto and Fuji in Nara, Japan. They pinned me.
This is like Ed Langley, because all our matches in Calgary as a team, Ed would always protect me.
Yeah, exactly, right? But yes, yeah, so that's fun. And I remember there was a parking lot show that we had, which must have just been a little spot show. And that's the one where I had to get color. And then we had to go straight to the hotel. And I remember checking into the hotel just covered in blood because I didn't bother taking my gear off. And it was muddy and dusty. I remember that poor person behind the counter was like just terrified at this crazy gaijin.
Texas with chainsaw massacre. Who is this person?
Blood all over us and everything like that.
Do you remember it was in the Star Lanes. I forget the name of the city.
Hakata.
We popped because it was a bowling alley.
Yes.
And the local CNWA worked in a room at the back of a bowling alley. So we thought that was great. But that was, I believe, also the night we did the Street Fight Battle Royal.
Yeah.
Which was a battle royal, but you had to get pinned in it to be eliminated.
Right.
And I don't think either of us had street fight gear because we weren't aware of that. For some reason, I think you wore like Zubaz shorts or something.
That's exactly right.
And so we had the Street Fight Battle Royal as well as, I believe, a tag match as well, because I have visions of me in our orange gear doing a flying elbow on Shooter, I think, actually, in that show.
It's funny, but yeah, it's good memory, man. It's Hakata is actually like in Fukuoka, which is in the south part of Japan. So that was you and I, and Ultraman was our partner that night against Ricky Fuji, Honda, who later became Mr. Gonosuke, and Shooter, who became the Punk. But the funny thing about the Hakata Star Lane is that I remember, and maybe, I don't know if we said it then, but I'll definitely say it now. We trained in a bowling alley, worked our asses off to go to Japan to wrestle in a bowling alley.
And similarly, off topic, but my Lebanon tour, I remember thinking it's like, I trained in Calgary, I worked in Calgary, I flew all the way to Beirut, and I'm wrestling Jerry Morrow. It's like, I'm working the same guy.
And just 10,000 miles away. Well, let's talk about, there's a great story that you told that I only remembered when you told it. And I got one too, a partying story. You mentioned the lobby parties.
Yeah, there was one town because they, you know, they always booked us in the, you know, the business hotels, the North American style hotels. I have a memory of something going on in the city that was big, and all the hotels we'd usually stay in were booked. And this was a Japanese style hotel. Like, I think a couple of the Americans had like the bedroll on the floor. My room had a bed, but it was not the cleanest, nicest hotel. I remember there being like a used bar of soap in the shower. Like, I didn't even get into the bedding. I put a towel over the pillow and just stayed in my clothes and slept. But there was nothing anywhere around. So, and we had a fair bit of time to kill for some reason. And we all ended up, because there was, you know, beer vending machines in the lobby. So we all, I don't have memory of Ultraman and Pandita with us, but Mark, Horace, and Mike.
Yeah.
And the two of us just, hey, let's just leave our bags in the room and we'll come down and sit in the lobby. And we went down to the lobby, and everyone, with exception of me, I assume, was drinking beer and getting quite hooped in the lobby of this hotel. I don't remember who went first, but one actually made the mistake of hitting the button for a lager rather than a beer. Again, Mike and Horace were family as well as good friends. And whoever accidentally bought the lager first pawned it off on the other guy. And the other guy was hot that, you know, you made the mistake. Why do I get the lager? And we're drunk. So it's like, what the hell? And he's all mad. And then the next round, the guy who got the lager went and purposefully bought the lager to give to the other guy. And then they started getting hot. And like, I don't remember who it was, but one of them,
I remember who it was. I know exactly
threw
who it was.
The lager at the other guy with an F you, you're not giving me a goddamn lager. You, and this poor scared to death, you know, 80-year-old tiny Japanese guy behind the desk of the hotel. And I'm sitting there going, oh, they're going to call the cops. We're all going to jail.
That's exactly correct. But Boulder accidentally bought the lager for Mike Awesome. Mike Awesome on purpose bought the lager and gave to Boulder. Boulder was the one who freaked out because, like I said, Boulder's legit Hogan's nephew. So there's a lot of similarities in the way that they look and the way that they, and I remember him talking, thinking he sounds like fucking Hogan, going like, I can't do whatever Hogan, that kind of Southern drawl, like a little bit. He's like, it's not fair, man. It's not like you did it on purpose and I didn't do it on purpose. And that's just being an asshole, man. Like whatever he was saying. And he was just so hurt that his cousin would have done it on purpose. Cause mine was an accident. I didn't mean to. And you did this on purpose. You and threw the lager and then they're fighting. And I vividly remember that after you said it, that Boulder was so hurt and betrayed that Mike Awesome would have bought the wrong beer on purpose.
We eventually, I think Mark stepped up and we eventually calmed them down because we were afraid that the guy at the desk would call the company on us.
Yeah.
And calmed it down. But yeah, it was so funny.
And the Ultraman you mentioned, because I just remember we would go to these places and then it was after a while. I was like, I can tell you meals that I had in Japan for most of it, but I can't remember really eating anything except for that first night at Lawson. And I remember this Ultraman going, okay, Kentucky. And you'd find Kentucky Fried Chicken and it was like an oasis. And Ultraman, he could speak a little Japanese. He was really cool. He was kind of like the liaison.
And I remember Kentucky. The biscuits and the honey with the Kentucky was a huge treat.
Was a huge treat. I remember also, that's when we found out, you probably didn't, but that's when there was the machines by the TV that you could put 100 coin yens and you could watch a porno for about 2 minutes and the privates would be scrambled, right? And I remember Ultraman was going, amigo, do you like the puerno? Do you like puerno? Like, I still use that to this day. Do you like the puerno? Another party that we had was on the back of the bus one night. We must have had a long drive. It was tequila and those big Japanese apples, the pear apples.
In my memory, this was the last night. We finished the last show, and this was the celebration on the way back to Tokyo is my memory of that.
Right. And so I had a big Band-Aid on my face. Look at this picture. It's me, you, Mark Starr, and Gladiator, or Gradiator, as they called him over there. All three of us have terrible mullets. You just have the box cut, and everyone's got apples and tequila. I'm wondering, did you take a shot, Lance, that night?
If I had to guess, I would say yes.
I think you did.
but I don't recall it. But I could see me taking one just for the sake of the camaraderie of the situation.
Right.
So I could see me taking one very tiny sip and then chowing down on the apple. But that was also, again, the last night of the tour is when we actually got to work with Horace and Mike.
Yes.
And it was the big Gaijing match. And the shock of all shocks is we were beating them.
Yes.
Because we were the new younger guys and they were, you know, pretty big stars. So we were like, man, we're, you know, they're putting us over. They're definitely bringing us back. This is going to be great. And I also remember because one of the spots we used to have, you know, we do the blind tag spot or whatever. And it's like I'd run the ropes and duck the clothesline and then I'd slingshot you in and you'd clothesline the guy when he turned around.
Mm-hmm.
We did this where we tried to do this with Horace Boulder. And I remember we specifically, because this is a nice thing, we're actually all in the same locker room, so we could talk shit out. We're like, oh, well, this is going to be great. So we described the spot. It's like, I'll duck, and you know, you just turn around. And I remember when we did the spot, I duck, and I grab the rope, and I slingshot you. And as you're coming in, I look, and Mark's, or Horace is like just coming off the other far rope. And he's like 18 feet away from you. And I'm like, Chris ain't going to make it. And I remember afterwards talking to him. It's like, dude, where were you? He's like, oh, I wanted to make it better.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to run into it. So I ran away to run into it.
But yeah, the timing didn't work. I remember thinking, it's like, dude, don't help us, please.
And what happened in that match is the reason why they had us pinned, it wasn't just because we were the hot young upstarts. They were turning on each other.
Yeah, planting the seed to break them up.
And actually, this is the one match that I won. I got to pin the Gladiator with a backslide. And so I was like, wow, that's pretty cool. Because I think Gladiator or Boulder was holding me. Gladiator came for a clothesline. I duck. He hits Boulder. I backslide him 1, 2, 3. And they start fighting. And then the next tour, they would come back and that would be the match. Boulder versus Gladiator.
Yes. We were told we were going to come back in January and 6 times next year.
Yes. Yes. They were very happy with us. And listen, judging by the booking and the fact they put us in that last match and had us beat their two top guys at the time, that's not just willy-nilly booking. There's obviously some kind of a plan there, I would think, wouldn't you?
Yeah, because they could have had one of the Japanese guys pick up the win if they, you know, if it was just about them breaking up.
Yes.
And that was sort of the weird thing, too, that we were babyface foreigners, which was sort of a unique situation.
They called us, when we first started, we first came over there, they were calling us Canada's Steiner Brothers, which is strange because we weren't the Steiner Brothers at all. But I think they just meant from a dynamic standpoint, we had that type of a feel or a vibe to us, maybe.
Yeah. And, you know, Steiners were a big deal. So I guess that gives us a good rub by being mentioned in the same breath.
Another thing I was going to say about the tequila apple party is that was the night, too, where they just attacked Ito and stripped him of all his clothes. And he was just standing in the middle of the bus like he was, I think, a little bit drunk, too. And he just started like getting into it. I remember he had this little wee wiener. Mark Starr was like, you fuck with that thing? Ah. And Ito was just like, ah. He wasn't like, it was just, I remember they were like a pack of animals just tearing off this guy's clothes just for a rib. There's your rib for you.
Yep. Classic.
Do you remember the you and I got in a scuffle?
I do. I remember, I have no idea how it started, but we're, you know, wrestling around. Like we're not throwing punches. We're wrestling around for whatever reason. In my mind, we were just fucking around.
Right.
And we're grappling, tussling, rolling around like or whatever until you grab a handful
of your package.
That was the end of that. I let go with a what the hell? Again, I think your description was sort of the one is like, you know, it was 3 weeks. It was a long tour.
Yeah.
And sometimes brothers don't always get along and we were venting some frustrations.
Yeah, I think I probably got a little bit more excited about it than you did, only because, like you said, it wasn't quite 3 weeks. It's actually closer to two. With traveling, it was October 10th was the first match. October 24th was the last match. But if you look at this, we worked on the 10th, 11th, 12th, 14th, 16th, 17th, and we had 18 and 19 off. So there's a lot of off days there. And the fact that I can't remember doing anything of merit tells me that we're probably pretty freaking bored, just kind of hanging around.
They took us to Hiroshima one day.
Oh, that's right. Wow.
I've got pictures of that.
That might be where Mark Starr thought that we saw them banging each other.
Could be, yes.
Yeah, because it was that area with the monument and everything's kind of in the mountains.
Yeah. So they took us to that for a sightseeing adventure one day, but it's also just culture shock. Like, we'd never been anywhere and we're wrestling quite regularly. And it's funny too, because I could see where, again, it would have bothered me if it was the other way, but I didn't even notice. Like, maybe I did at the time, but it's like our tag run in Calgary, because Ed was had his hand in the booking all the time and Ed didn't like you as much as he did me. It's like there was times where we'd do 2 out of 3 fall matches and it's like you'd get pinned for the fall we lose and I'd get the pin for both times that we win. And even our first show, it's like I win the Royal Rumble main event. I could see there when we go to Japan, if that's the same situation, I could see where you're getting hot.
Yeah.
Maybe I did notice, or probably not, because I'm just green going, man, I'm picking up the win. I'm happy. And I don't see the other side of poor Chris. He's getting pinned all the time.
Well, but that, and like you said, back at that time frame, it means something, because, you know, it's like, I remember even in camp, because you were so much more technically perfect. I was just getting like, I remember you, like I said, we talk about all the time, you do the perfect leg drop and then kind of look at me with that look on your face, like, you're not even trying to be a dick. It's just you.
Yeah.
Like, that's a Lance Storm. Like, boom, that's how it's done. I'd be like, this motherfucker. I can't even do a leg drop. I still, to this day, have never done a leg drop in a match, ever. I've had 32 years experience. I've never done a leg drop. I can't do them. It's just, and that's okay. But at the time, like, I couldn't do a springboard. I couldn't jump right from the mat up to the top rope like you could.
Remember the catch of the foot, do a backflip?
Yes.
The time you tore a chunk of hair out of your head?
Because they landed on my head on the lawn.
But it's funny, and it's the insecurity of being the green guy where you want to be able to do everything. I was the exact same way, but it was over your personality and ability to talk.
Right.
That I was like, totally, it's like, oh my God, this guy, you know, I thought you were like Hulk Hogan charisma level in our first match.
Yeah, that's right. You said that too.
And was just blown away. And that's the insecurity of the green guy, is you want to be able to do everything perfect first out. And I'm just like, oh my God, Chris has just got all this charisma and this personality. It's like, he's so great.
Yeah.
And then you look at what I was doing better than you, and I look at what you were doing better than me, and there's that insecurity of being young and green.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm picking up the win, I'm just happy because I'm young and green, and it's like I don't realize that you're the one taking the falls. And had it been the other way, I'd have been the insecure guy going, God damn it.
You might feel the same way, right? Yeah. Do you remember, like, I remember one of the other things, just a couple few kind of ragtag stories. When I got there, like I mentioned, I was a big fan of loudness, and I thought when we go to Japan, loudness is going to be everywhere, and they weren't. They you know, they were an 80s band that did okay. But I remember going to a cassette shop at the time and saying, is there any like heavy metal, Japanese heavy metal? And there was this band that was called X. And I'd never heard them before. Obviously, just a Japanese band. I bought the cassette. Well, here, fast forward at 30 years, the guy behind is a guy called Yoshiki, who is one of the biggest celebrities in Japan. And when X, they're called X Japan. Now, when X Japan comes to the States, they sell out Madison Square Garden. They're like massive. But I discovered them like in 1991 and brought them back to my friends in Canada. Go, you guys got to listen to this band. And they just became this legendary, you know, almost like a U2 or something like that of Japan. It's just interesting to me that I found them way back then, to when I met Yoshiki about 3 or 4 years ago. I was freaking out. Yoshiki, blah, blah, blah. He's like, how do you know me? I was like, dude, I've known you since 1991. But it's just interesting how even that was kind of like, it was a brave new world. Like you mentioned, even eating the pachinko parlors. We did a lot of that where.
Oh my God. Yes.
Which are, to explain what a pachinko parlor is.
I'm assuming they were betting machines, yes. Sort of a hybrid between a casino and a arcade.
Yeah.
You know, they just sit at these machines constantly putting in their money and stuff. And they're very loud and very bright.
Yeah, you would put in money. I believe there was even some kind of a, if there wasn't some kind of an arm that you pull, you push a button. And if you win, you win little steel balls.
That's right. The ball bearings.
The ball bearings. And that's why it's so loud, because you're constantly hearing like that. Bing, 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 bing. And they still have them there to this day. And then you collect, it, almost like a Japanese version of tickets that you would get like at a Chuck E. Cheese or something. You take your ball bearings and you take it to the front, and then you get prizes or money or whatever it is. So they were all over the place. I remember we did a lot of that. Being my first international tour, I did take a lot of pictures. And that's why I have so many of them and wanted to put a lot of them in the Complete List of Jericho.
Do you remember the cassette tape I purchased at the music store, being such a big music guy myself?
I don't.
I, being the complete loser with no knowledge of music, I bought a New Japan Pro Wrestling entrance music cassette. I wish I still had it.
Yeah, that's funny. I remember too, because right before we went, that's when I was, you were dating Rosa.
Yes.
Remember Rosa? And I was dating her friend, Levina was her name. And I parked in front of her place and somebody stole all the cassettes out of my car.
The briefcases of cassettes.
They stole them all. And somehow my dad was able to get it covered under home insurance. And I got a check for like $300. And I went to the music store and bought like 30.
I went with you. You were like a kid in a candy store.
And I remember still on that tour opening the cassettes on the Japanese tours, because you know, it's Walkmans back then, but there were still unwrapped cassettes because I didn't have time to listen to them all because we had come to Japan, you know? I also remember that I had the cassette for our ring music, which at the time was Overnight Sensation by a band called Firehouse. And I gave it to their music guy. And that was our music that we used.
Okay.
The last day of the tour, they didn't give me my cassette. And I was like, I got to get my cassette back. And I made the whole van of the Foreigners wait for them to run back to the office and get my cassette. I remember like Mark Stargo, what are you waiting for? It's like, my ring music. He goes, your ring music? Well, what is it? Well, it's a Firehouse cassette. I'll fucking buy you a Firehouse cassette. We're going. Because Mark was a little bit of a dick. He had a little dickish side to him. He was the one out of the three, like Mike Awesome, just a good old boy, bold of the same. Mark Stark, because even in WCW, he was the same, kind of a little bit of an asshole. And I don't blame him. Like, can you imagine waiting for some idiot holding up the whole bus because you don't have your cassette? It's $9.99 at freaking, you know, Sam's Record Man or whatever.
And do you remember when we got called into the office by Goto to be paid?
Well, tell me your collection.
Because the end of the tour, you'd get, you know, you all line up outside of his hotel room and you'd go in and they would pay you cash.
Yes.
And thankfully we got called in together and he looks up and he's like, oh, you're to be paid, you know, $600 a week. You took, you know, $300 in advances, 3 weeks, 18. So here's $1,500 each or whatever. And they start counting out the money. And I recall looking at you with, our contract said 800.
Mm-hmm.
He just said six. And I'm like, should we say anything? But again, I'm scared because I was like, I don't want to, you know, we're told you're coming back next year. You got six tours coming. I don't want to complain about my money. And I'm like, should we say something? And you're like, I think so. And then you spoke up and just, you know, no disrespect, but we were told and our contract said 800. And Goto, in my recollection, says, I was wondering, 600 seems kind of small. You guys were really good. I will check. And if that's correct, we will send you the extra $600.
Yeah.
And we're like, thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. And we left. If they sent it, Fred kept it.
That's a possibility. Because the guy, a couple more details about the guy, the liaison, his name was Sakai. He was a magazine writer that was kind of the English liaison. He was in that room with us because Goto didn't speak great Japanese. Sakai was like kind of the middleman. And yeah, like you said, we'll send you the money. I remember they also said, Onita wants you for six tours. Because the last day of the tour, I remember the vibe was like, don't talk to Onita.
Yes.
And I was like, I don't know, rebel or like, whatever. I'm going to go talk to him. Like, hey, dude, like, thanks for having us or whatever. And I remember he kind of looked at me like I was completely insane. But every other time I've met Onita, he's looked at me like that too, maybe three or four times total. And I don't know if that was an insult to him that I went and said hi or he was interested, like oh, this is strange. But I remember just him just looking at me like I had three heads, that the fact I went and said hi to him.
When you said that, I just remembered now, and I think it was the only time I actually, other than potentially getting punched by him in that match, right near the end of the tour, didn't Ito come over and grab the two of us and say, Onita wants to speak with you, and took us to the babyface locker room.
Maybe that was it. Yeah.
And I think Onita, and again, maybe he did say, you know, you listen, you don't speak or whatever, but we came over and we're all, you know, bowing our heads, trying to be polite. And Onita said that he was very happy with us.
Yes.
And that he wanted us back six times next year. And maybe that's when you spoke up.
Maybe. Yeah. Cause he just kind of looked at us kind of strangely. And that must be what it was. Cause you're right. He did. See, here's the thing that to this day, it's still, actually, and I have a theory of what happened. We can discuss that. They brought us in. Maybe it was Fred's suggestion. Maybe it was just they liked our look. It took a couple matches to get our groove on. And then they really enjoyed having us. Because once again, we gave them something different. It's a lot like the Cruiserweights in WCW in 97, 98, where it was something completely different that made the company stronger. And we only had 70 matches between us, but we were fairly good for that level. And we could work with Izaki and, like you said, Goto. really wanted to work with us and all these other guys. You know, that's why I always kind of wondered, why didn't they bring us back? What do you think? Why do you think they didn't bring us back?
I always wanted to blame Fred.
Yeah.
And my memory is when we got back, Fred pulled the, you can't work for anybody else now. You're complete with us. And I have the memory of us going, no, we have to work and keep sharp. We are still going to wrestle. And we took non-Fred bookings in Calgary. So I suspect that he nixed us.
Yeah. The reason why I think that too is, that happened to me a couple of the times in my career, except for my boss told me. I remember one time with Tenru, Vampiro had told him I didn't want to work there anymore. Oh. And Tenru asked me about it. I was like, no. And he had done the same thing to me in Mexico with Paco Alonso. I think Fred probably told them that they're not available. They didn't like it. They don't want to come back because there's no reason for them not to bring us back. We worked cheap.
Yep.
They didn't pay us the money, or maybe they did and Fred kept it. We got along with everybody because it's the same old story with Boulder and Mark and Gladiator. Once they got to know us and respected our work, that's how you get over with the boys. That's how I got over in WWE when I worked with Bob Holly for, 3 or 4 months. And then he's telling guys, oh, the guy's really good. Like, you should give him a chance. We had become friends with those guys.
Yep.
There was really no reason for them not to bring, there was no reason for them to string us along and lie to us. And plus, as we know, Japanese don't do that. They'll just say like, maybe we call you, or, they won't say, it wasn't a stroke job what they told us.
Yeah. So I think it had to have been Fred, and it was because we weren't completely, thank you, Fred. Thank you, Fred. Yeah. Yes, we will only work for you. Here's 20% of our money. You're such a great person. We didn't suck up to Fred when we come back. And I think that's why we didn't go back. Again, you ended up going back for that one show, but that was it.
Well, and then we could just have a little quick epilogue on that. So in September of 92, so 9 months later, or 11 months later, they call us finally to go work a stadium show in Kanagawa. I believe that was Onita versus Tiger Jeet Singh. It was one of the first stadium shows that they'd had. And then the whole time, like, I wanted to go back so bad. And when they finally gave us the call, I was so excited. You had a different mindset.
Yeah, we'd gone our separate ways. Like, we were still friends. We're still in Calgary, but we're doing singles now.
Yeah.
And when they called, there was two things. One, it was like going back to the team just felt like a step back.
Right.
But I really hated Fred.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, too, I had a bit of a, no, FMW, Onito lied to me. He said 6 times next year, you come back in January. And it's like, they call us in September. I felt lied to by FMW, which maybe they didn't. Maybe it was all Fred. But I knew Fred was a piece of shit I didn't want to deal with. And it's like, I didn't want the headache of dealing with Fred. So I just decided, it's like, nope, I'm saying, no to the first booking I've ever said no to, and decided not to go back.
And that to me was like, it was so like, and you're totally right. Like, you made the right decision. I was just like, I want to get out of here. I want to go back to Japan. Like, I really did like it there, and we hadn't gotten any other offers. So when you say you didn't want to go, it's like, well, I'll just get another singer and continue the band. And so
and you got Eric Fries.
Eric Fries, and then had to track down our jacket, the one that Lenny's mom made that's now been immortalized in an action figure. But you had sold yours or something, or given it away to the white
one or the other. Yeah, I don't recall. But yeah, it was someone, I assume, probably sold it to him. Yeah,
it was a guy called the White Dog, Jason Wilkinson. I don't remember that. He was a referee, but he also wrestled as the White Dog. He was probably this big. And I was like, hey, dude, I need to borrow it. He wouldn't let me borrow it. And I was like, no, you're going to let me borrow it. Or all whatever. So I was able to get that. And then we went over there and, listen, Eric was meat and potatoes. He was all right, but he wasn't Lance Storm. And I remember we first went there, Goto went, Bruns, you lose weight. It's like, no, this is a different guy. His name was Eric Fries, but they couldn't pronounce Fries. So his name was Eric Hool over there.
Yeah, which is actually his real name, I believe.
I think so. Yeah, exactly. As we kind of wrap up, what are your kind of final memories of that experience and kind of how do you look back on that?
I look back on pretty much every trip favorably because it was such a big deal. And just the photo we have,
yeah.
I assume it was when we finally got back to Tokyo, of all of the FMW crew, us, out in front of the hotel taking that group photo. And it was so great to be in a different group of people than the local Calgary guys.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, your new group of friends from another company. And it just felt like this was a really big, important step that we weren't just good enough to survive the local crappy shows in Calgary. It's like, this is a different country, a different stage, and we did well.
Yeah.
And it was sort of a degree of validation.
I agree. It, you know, like you said, you think you can make it, we'll go out there and see. And it gave me a lot of confidence. The weight of and all that match and all that stuff. Like Goto was he liked us. He was fun to work with. Izaki was great. I remember always Shooter was a little bit of a rough guy to work with, but I remember I liked with being with him. We were working with new guys. And once again, you're not calling any high spots.
Mm-hmm.
And also too, that established a friendship with Izaki and I, because I saw him 2 years later in Mexico and hung out with him he was over there for about 2 or 3 months. And we hung out quite a bit.
Cool.
There's a great picture of us backstage in Reno, Mexico, sharing a cigarette of all things, but they're just a great guy, you know, and even working with Onita, who then I worked with again in WAR and knocked him out in the middle of the sumo arena with a lion saw where the knee hit him in the fucking head. But I mean, I was talking to Meltzer and we were talking about somebody that passed away that had worked with so many people. And I was like, I might be the next guy that's worked with more generational big names than anybody else at this point in time. Because if you look at it, like Onita is on that list, you know, and all those guys from Japan, all the guys from Mexico, all of our Calgary guys, all, you know, ECW, WCW, it goes on and on and on. But I remember just being in the ring with Onita and Goto. I mean, those are two fairly big names that we can say we worked with.
Yeah, absolutely.
But really did enjoy it. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why I was so desperate to go back, because I just wanted to be there again. But we eventually did go back and had amazing careers in Japan. Is there a match that stands out for you from the tour that was your favorite?
I don't remember where it was, but to me, it was the first one that we really sort of felt like we found our groove and stars. I remember it was like in a gym or something. And walking to the ring, it's like the crowd was standing and we sort of had to walk through the people. And it felt like there was like a bit of a tunnel of people that we were walking through, getting a big reaction. And it was like the first time I felt really like we're over, like we're stars here. And again, it was probably against Izaki and someone else, but it was like, I think it was sort of like here's two, you know, Japanese young lions. And it's like, you guys go out there and you win. And we went out and hit, you know, our double team moves and stuff. And won. And it really felt like we're getting a push, we're getting over, we're being stars or whatever. It felt like a big moment for me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also, I don't know if it was that match, I did my very first dive to the floor in FMW, and it was Izaki. And I remember, I guess it was somewhere where we could talk to them, because I had said that maybe I would dive, and just said, so if you are on the floor, keep your eyes open. I might do, you know, house show dive, plancha. Because they had the blue mats on the floor,
mm-hmm.
just the little strips of blue mats, not all the way around. And I'm thinking, it's like, wow, there's a mat there. I could do a dive. And I did the plancha. And when I landed, we completely cleared the mats and I just landed on the gym floor and didn't get hurt. And I'm like, oh, I guess I don't really need the mats. And it was like my very first dive. So those were the two memories that really stuck out for me.
Yeah, because we were there, like you mentioned, just to clarify one thing too, we got paid 3 weeks because they would pay us on 6 days, not seven.
Yeah.
So we were technically there with travel, like 18 days, whatever was total. But that time that we were there, that was probably, I would guess, in the second week. Because the first week we were there, then the magazines come out because there was weekly magazines. And I bet you there was a lot, they gave us a lot of great coverage, color photos and all that sort of stuff. That probably helped with us getting over. For me, it was the first match, just kind of getting thrown into this blood sport arena, having no idea what to do, fighting for our lives, and then surviving and going like, all right, we did it. Great times, man. Great memories. And I'm glad that we're able to share that. It's hard to believe it was 32 years ago almost.
Yeah, no kidding. That means we're both older than 35.
Hey, you're going to be the same age as Ed Langley was when he trained us.
How crazy is that?
Yeah.
Like he would like,
he looked like he was 70
and told everybody he was 65.
All right, man. Well, it's always good to chat with you, and we'll have to pick another one of our tours or histories to do next time.
All right, man. Thanks, man.
Cheers, dude. Thanks.